For some of us who have been diligent enough to read the Bible, we come up against some really strange things that are written in Scripture. And chapters 25 to 35 are among really strange chapters. Like, what's going on? Right? I really appreciate you making the effort to read the Bible. Some of you, your leaders told you, must read through the whole Bible in 1 year or something, right? And you're trying very hard. It's really good. But you'll come up against stories like the one that you read in Jacob, and it's just strange. What do we make of it? And then there are, of course, those of us who have not read the Bible, and so you are not asking questions about this story. That's okay. But it's still of relevance to you, because if you are among those who take yes, I am ambitious. Yes, I want to make a lot of money. Then today's message about Jacob is really up your alley. You're going to like this guy. You know, I didn't, but you probably will. Jacob was quite an ambitious guy. I was just looking at the internet for advice on how to get what I want. So there are all these videos of people giving advice about how to get what you want. And one of them was giving advice that to get what you want, you have to visualize it in your mind. Think about it every day. You know, think about the benefits you get from it. A whole video on that. Another one said, you have to speak that of yourself. So like you hold up a 10-cent coin and you say, I am a million-dollar man. Say that every day and you believe it. The good will come to you. Okay, sounds good. I am a million-dollar woman. Right. So we have many angles in that we try to take in order to get what we want. Especially if you ticked on the yes side, which is, yeah, I am ambitious and I do want to make a lot of money. The only problem I found with these videos is that they always talk about what you can do. You must believe in yourself. You must imagine the future. You must rehearse in your mind what it will be like when you are successful or whatever, right? I mean, they give all those. But one thing I have found in trying to follow some of that advice is they don't say something more, which I find is very true about the situations I'm in, is that many times when I'm trying to get ahead in life, it's not just about me. There's always someone else in the way, right? Like that kid who got position 36 in the class. The problem is not that he got 36, it's that he has 35 people in front of him. If they weren't there, he wouldn't have that problem. If you've ever been hired by a company and you were the blue-eyed boy, congratulations. Enjoy that for a season. Because after a season, as all of us know who have been in working world, by the by, they hire someone else. And that person becomes that blue-eyed boy for the next season, right? And it's not me anymore. So, and then what happens if it's, you know, in the family and you're trying to, you know, move ahead and the problem is someone else in your family, like a sibling who's in the way, right? So all this advice about getting ahead and getting what you want and visualizing and all that, I just find like, well, what do you do with a guy who's in front of you? You got to get rid of him somehow, you know. So how? So that's kind of the situation that Jacob was in. Now, let's do a little rerun about Jacob. We have Grandpa Abraham. Grandpa Abraham, he thought that the son Ishmael that he had with a maidservant Hagar would be the one to take over all his wealth, and also the promises of God would go through him. But God had told Abraham, no, you want Ishmael in my blessing? Yes, 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 I bless him. But you know, that child that my covenant will go through is through whom I will have the whole earth blessed, right? That means all the earth will receive the blessing. Later on, we know is the deliverer, the Messiah that he will send, right? And therefore, as you have seen in Adam, in Noah, and even when you sacrifice your son Isaac and I provided a ram, the solution must always come from me. I was the one who covered Adam with the skin. I was the one who came up with the idea for the ark and worked with Noah. I was the one who provided the ram. So I will provide this child, Isaac. Yes, you are 100 years old. Yes, your wife is 90. It will be a miracle. It will be from my hand. So that it will continue. Everyone will know that the solution must come from me. It's not going to come from your efforts. It didn't come from Cain's efforts. It wouldn't come from yours either. So now, Abraham has his son Isaac. Woohoo! You know, God has fulfilled his promise. El Olam, the eternal God, who continues and fulfills his promises. He is not limited by time. Hooray! Now, Isaac has his wife. How he got his wife, you have to go and read up. It's quite interesting. But anyway, how he finally got his wife, trusting God. It was actually quite difficult. But anyway, he trusted God, and God did get him someone. And this lady called Rebecca actually had a similar problem as Sarah. So Sarah was actually somewhat related as well. So I don't know whether there's a genetic issue. So she also had a problem conceiving, but Isaac had prayed for Rebecca, and then God gave her twins, right? And so in Abraham's mind and in Isaac's mind, both the twins, Esau and Jacob, both of them that were in the mother's womb, right? Both would be the recipients of the covenant, the promises of God, that God had promised to Abraham and then to Isaac, that this land will be yours. So, all this land will go to Isaac, therefore it will go to both Esau and Jacob, as well as a blessing to bless the whole earth will also go through both Esau and Jacob. Both would be the covenant children. Right? So you have Isaac, covenant goes through him. You have two covenant children. So exciting. Isaac was excited. Abraham was excited. God was excited. Right? Well, it seemed like the two kids didn't get along too well because they were always fighting in the womb. And apparently when they were born, Jacob was grabbing onto the heel of his brother. In their language, the idea of grabbing onto a heel is you're trying to trip up someone in order to take his place. It's kind of like in a race when you are running the 400 meters, and then you trip up someone so that you hit the finish line first. That kind of idea, right? So when he came up, his hand was on his brother's heel, and so they called him heel grabber, which in their language meant could also mean someone who trips up someone else in order to take his place, whether by force or by deceit. Well, of course, everyone put that heel-grabbing thing behind them, and Jacob and Esau grew up with Grandpa Abraham telling them stories. And what kind of stories? Well, think about it. Grandpa Abraham would have told about how the Most High, El Elyon, had called him out from Haran and had given him these promises. What promise? That this land will be his, that they would be a great nation of people. He would also have told about Noah. Noah was still alive at the time. Noah and the God of Noah, how he is the one who judges the whole earth. And we are to fear him and walk righteously in his ways. And who knows, they might even met Noah, who would have, they would have access to some of the writings of Adam, right? Which explains how man had once been one with God, but had since chosen to reject him. And it was a betrayal of an intimate relationship. And God had provided the animal that would cover Adam. And this was the promise of what he would do in future. Isaac would have had his own stories to tell. What stories would Isaac have told? Probably he would tell of the time when he walked up the mountain with the wood on his back and how he felt and what he was wondering. Perhaps the struggle of whether he should submit to his father or not. And perhaps Isaac, in submitting to his father, had then told Esau and Jacob that who knows what God is trying to tell us. But do you think perhaps someday there will be a deliverer who would also walk up a mountain like this one with the wood on his back and would himself submit to the father as the sacrifice? So he would be asking his sons would be thinking with him. There's the possibility that it's the same region, right? They would have walked up the mountain together. Grandpa Abraham was fit. Okay, he's 100 plus, but he's fit. So he had walked up the mountain with them and told them of how when he walked up, he felt the grief of God. Why was God so sad? He was wondering that as he walked up the mountain. What is God trying to say? What is God sharing with him? So Jacob and Esau would have grown up knowing that this God of the universe is not far away, that he came close to Adam and formed him, that he shared his pain with Noah, that he called Abraham to walk with him from Haran out and fulfilled his promises to Abraham, and that he shared his grief with Abraham and then the promises to Isaac. So they would know of this God who seeks to draw close, who gives promises, fulfills his promises, and who has specially put a covenant promise on their dad, Isaac. Dad Isaac, right? So it will come to both of them. What do you think Esau, the big brother, and Jacob, the little brother, thought? You know, as they're growing up, they're standing down there, and then Abraham is down there putting the big rocks, and then he'll ask them to bring the wood, and then he shows them how he sacrifices the animal, and he explains to them what he is doing, why he's doing that, why must this lamb take my place? And Esau and Jacob are down there staring and watching from the side, maybe helping to carry water here and there to wash Abraham's hands or something like that, right? So now they are young adults, around about 15, 16 years old. In those days, there isn't adolescence. So by this age, they're considered young adults, right? So at this point, that's the incident that many of you all read the Bible, and then now you're wondering about that, right? So apparently, Esau comes in, right? So let's all read the text together. I gave the verse there. on the first page. Okay, so everyone, please help to read the verse. 1, 2, 3. Now, people always wonder, you know, as you read this, generally as a Asian, most of us, maybe if you are from a different culture, you would be different, but most of us, when we read this, we feel for who? Esau or Jacob? Most of, yeah lah, Esau lah. All of us feel for Esau. Ma. This is a normal Asian thing, right? It's like, wow, he's hungry, then you don't want to share, right? Since young, mommy told us, must share, right? This, our society is very for harmony, so we're like, And then we also don't like people who are grabbers, who are opportunistic, who take advantage of other people. Even if we do that, we just don't say out, right? Just do it underneath, right? Because we know socially, generally, people don't like that. So when I read this, I also get a bad impression of Jacob. I think, don't like him. And one of the reasons why we also flow with Esau is actually because we live in a society that is like Esau. What do I mean by we are like Esau? Okay, in order to explain how we are like Esau, you need to first understand what is a birthright. Okay, so if you don't mind, I'm going to do some cultural explanation. Maybe for your families or your cultures have other ways of dividing inheritance, but I'm just going to explain to you what Jacob and Esau understood. Okay, so we've gone to the next slide, which is the birthright, and I gave you the table in your notes as well. So there are three parts to a birthright. You can see that in your notes. I put the first one here. And the first one has to do with authority. When dad Isaac passes on, the firstborn, who's the firstborn? Esau, yeah. So firstborn Esau will take over the father's place. He has authority over his family. Now in those days, they don't have nuclear families and everyone live in their own little apartment. It's not like that, right? Everyone lives together with the extended family. So what I mean is, you imagine your 团圆饭, all your uncle, auntie all come with all your cousins, right? And now you imagine that every single day. That's how it is. Right? Everyone lives together. So it's not like you all have one flat, and then only your home, your household, your mother, father, you, your brother, sister, like that, you know, and everybody take one room. They don't have everyone take one room. It's one whole family in one room, then your uncle's family in another room, then uncle another room, right? So you might have like 20, 30 people all living together under one roof. Right? So that's how they live together. So the oldest living male is the one who then has headship over the whole home. Now, why is that so? You might say, why do I need you to be the big boss? Well, it's like that. Because in that rather nomadic culture, you do not have a state or a government to take care of you. So the oldest living male has to think of how the economics is going to work in his extended family. He's going to make sure there's food for everyone, right? He's got to make sure the duties are done, right? Who takes the livestock out? Who prepares the lunch and dinner? Who is taking care of the kids, right? All this work is happening in this home. It's a bit like my mom was explaining to me, like a kibbutz, if you know, in Israel. Everyone lives together and it's a self-serving little, self-sufficient little community. Okay, so that's the authority part. So the head will have to decide, where shall our family go? Should we settle down somewhere? Should we go somewhere else to live, right? Because you have to take care of the well-being of your whole family, not your nuclear family. This is called extended households, the clan. Now, remember that in our view, as is like Esau, and we are the same as Esau because we are in a secular society. So our view is that the physical things, the physical needs like my appetite, right? My day-to-day, the today and now, like I'm very busy with the today and now, right? It might be a lot of things, you know, school or work or tuition or whatever, you know. Basically, my here and now is the most important. This is what it is in our society, right? The physical things are the most important. My here and now is the most important. In our secular society, we push the spiritual aspects of our being. We are spirit, soul, and body. But in our society, the soul and body aspects of our being is not accepted in normal society, right? So we are in a culture that is very much like Esau, where Esau sees the here and now as most important and his appetite as most important. From a Hebrew perspective, because there's body, soul, and spirit, a human is not just a physical body, but it's soul and spirit as well. So from the soul and spirit aspect, you see the other box. The authority would not just be about leading your family to so that your sheep and cattle have got good grass to eat. That would be the physical aspect that you have to settle. But because you are body, soul, and spirit, so there's the spiritual aspect. And what is the spiritual aspect of authority? It's this. When you are the person who's supposed to shepherd or lead your family, you have to help them to remember the covenant that God made with Isaac and then now Esau and Jacob and the whole extended family. When you get ready the altar and then you do the sacrifice with the animal and you come before God, your whole family will stand before you. And then you have to talk to your family and you have to explain to all your nephews and nieces and relatives to remember the covenant that God has made with us. This is our God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac. Now this is our God, the God of both Esau and Jacob. We all belong to Him. Let us be faithful to Him, right? So you have the privilege of standing before God. God will speak to you. You will mediate and speak to your people. You will remind them to be faithful. You will call them together. Call them together is a bit like Chinese New Year. You have the oldest male, right? Then all the other younger siblings all come and visit, all gather around the oldest sibling. So that's what's happening. They will all be there, and then the oldest sibling is the one who will be speaking to them and helping them to remember the Most High God. Okay, so we've got authority, and then we've got the money part. Oh, we all want the money part. Okay, let's talk about the money part. Okay, let's go on to the next slide. We have a little quiz. This math quiz is specially for those who have just finished PSLE, because you all just finished, you all know how to do problem sums. Okay, so all those who are 13, 14, you're closest to PSLE. So problem sum is like that. Isaac wants to divide his wealth among all his children. He has two sons. How should he divide his wealth among his children? Solution one, you divide into two. Half to you and half to you. Solution two, you divide by three. And three, you divide by four. Okay, you decide on which one is your solution. One, two, or three, and then you show, when I say 3, 2, 1, you show the number. Okay, this side, this side, this side. 3, 2, 1, show the number. What's your number? Okay, so generally people will put 2 lah, right? Because it's 2 sons, but actually the answer is 3. Because the eldest son will get a double portion. So he gets two parts, and then the younger son will get 1 part. Everyone else will get 1 part, right? And then, so at this point, of course, all of you who are the first, the eldest sibling, y'all are like, yes, thank you very much. I always knew there's something special about me, right? Yes, of course. I should get, everyone else gets 1 million, I get 2 million, right? The kind of thing. Ang pao money, everyone else get $50, I get $100. But of course, you know, that should be how it is. Okay. But before the rest of us who are not the first one start to, say, what like that? Not fair, you know, I just explained to you that the eldest one also has got responsibilities that does end up eating up more money. So for example, if you are the oldest male and in your family, you have sisters who did not marry out to another family, they are still the unmarried sisters are still in your family. It's your job to take care of them all the way until they pass on, right? So these are like the additional people. And then, of course, when you bring people together to come before God, whose sheep will you use to sacrifice, right? Not other people's sheep, ma. It's going to be yours, right? So some of that will be, of course, part of the cost. Well, so there are responsibilities and there are also privileges, you know, yeah. The privileges would be the spiritual ones that you can stand before God. Okay, so now we go on to the wealth part. You have that in your notes. The wealth part, the double portion, you already know that. But remember that because God is El Olam, the eternal God, who fulfills His promises forever, so He is not limited by time. So therefore, because of the spiritual aspect of God being present, remember, it's not just me as an individual physical body, right? There's this God involved, there's the spiritual aspect. So there is also the long-term aspect, meaning the stuff that God has promised for the future, if the birthright comes to you, then all the promises for the future will also be yours, right? So in business language, those who do accountancy and finance, yesterday I met 2 of you, yeah. So I only did level 1, and I learned that accrual is when you do business and then someone else owes you the money, but in future they are going to pay. It's future income, right? So when you have a business, this accrual is an asset, because it's going to come in, right? So if you know that you have accrued income, you will keep doing business with that person because he's going to pay. I mean, by the by, he will pay. It's just as that accrued income has not come in. But, of course, if someday you think that this person is irresponsible and he's not going to pay, then you would change the accrued income into bad debt. And you'll say, wow, owe money, never pay money. Then you'll cut off relationship with this irresponsible customer, and you don't want to do business with him anymore, right? So there's this future aspect in any business. Okay, now let's go back to the text. Can we hop back to the first slide, please? The second slide, which is the one on the story. So now, what's happening here? When Esau comes in and he's hungry, he is thinking of his stomach. Now, of course, none of us think that's a problem. But the reason none of us thinks that's a problem is because we also, like Esau, are secular. Because we, none of us, thinks of the spiritual at the center of our lives. Esau thinks of his stomach, and so do we. Right? That's just how it is. That's the society we are in. So the here and now and the busy things take up all our time, and we feel that's fine. That's just how things should be. So when he is hungry and Jacob says, hey, that birthright we've been talking about, I want it. How about a legit barter trade? Okay. Now, we don't like Jacob, but you know, it's a business proposal, right? So we're using a lot of like money terms here, like business terms, right? So if you got a good deal, like fire sale of a flat, right? You're not going to think, oh, fire sale, the poor guy needs money. That's why he had to sell his flat. I'm going to help donate to him so that he can keep his flat. You don't want, you're thinking fire sale, I quickly buy, right? I mean, that's how business works. So Jacob is now like, whoa, you know, I want that birthright. Now, you just think about it. I was trying out this like toilet analogy with another group, trying to see whether it would help. So let's say two men, one is super rich. In his money, he has a lot of money. In his pocket, he has a lot of money, $10,000 notes, right? And they go toilet because they went out together, right? Then go toilet. Then the rich man's cubicle has no toilet paper. Okay, so he go and cock the other side and say, "Hey, pass over one piece of toilet paper." Now you are on the other cubicle. Aha! What is the opportunity you have? You know, in his pocket, he has a lot of $10,000 notes, right? Ah, so before you pass over the piece of toilet paper, what do you say to him? Let's have a legitimate barter trade. You give me one piece of the paper in your pocket, and I give you one piece of toilet paper. Right? Now, if you are the rich man, what will you say? You will say, go fly kite, or more than that lah. Right? Okay. So, because you know the value of that paper in your pocket. But let's say, if you said, okay, why not? I pass you one piece of paper, you pass me one piece of paper, both are paper. What does that mean about how you value that piece of paper in your pocket? Right? There is no difference between that piece of $10,000 note and the toilet paper. Now, let's say what I'm asking for before I pass over the toilet paper is not your money. But remember, because birthright has got the relational aspect, right? Not just the money aspect, but the relational aspect. So let's say you are quite serious with your girlfriend, quite serious with this fiancé. So you already bought this diamond engagement ring in your pocket. Then we went out together, then you show me, so I know it's in your pocket. So then I say, hey, I pass you this toilet paper, you pass me the diamond engagement ring. You know, of course you know the value of things. You will say no, right? It's not just the value of, yeah, you can go out and buy another diamond engagement ring. But hey, what does this mean? Right? What are you asking me for? Do you know what you're asking me for? Right? But let's say, this rich guy, this young guy with the diamond engagement ring said, okay lah, you want, I pass to you. Pass me the toilet paper, I pass to you. Right? Then what does that mean? Right? What does that mean, not only about that ring, but also about the relationship? And what happens if the fiancé, girlfriend, for whom he bought that ring for, is standing outside the toilet waiting for y'all, and then she heard what will happen inside? What will she conclude about what you are saying about their relationship? That is worthless, right? It's not even worth a piece of toilet paper that you're going to use and throw down the toilet bowl. And that is actually what Esau is saying. Don't come and say Esau doesn't know, as if he doesn't know that he will get the double portion. He certainly knows that. This is their culture. They know what a birthright is. Okay? And then of course you say, oh, don't be so hard on Esau lah. He's hungry, you know, right? His brains were not working. So after he ate the lentil stew is something like red bean soup, like that, right? Then he got the sugar in his brains. Wouldn't he then suddenly wake up and say, in horror, what have I done? You know, I will pay you back, you know, 200 bowls of, you know, beef stew in place of your red bean soup. but I will not let go of my birthright or something like that, right? But it says at the end, he ate, he got up, he left. He didn't even think twice about it. Now, especially for us who are younger, we think in a framework of a top and a bottom, and an oppressor and an oppressed. We are thinking the person at the top is always the bad guy, making things difficult for the victim at the bottom. This is the structure that we think of in society. So that's why we always have two sides. One is the good guy. The good guy is always at the bottom. The bad guy is always at the top, right? The powerful one is always the bad guy at the top, and then the weaker one is always the good guy at the bottom. This is the oppressor oppressed view of society and the world that we come from. So when we read this, immediately we have this oppressor oppressed view, and we're like, "Oh, poor Esau is the victim. How come God didn't help him out?" Right? We don't think of Esau because we're thinking of him as victim, right? We are not thinking of him as the active agent. He's the firstborn. He knows what he's going to get. He knows what a birthright is. And he didn't care. So like Lot chose and Lot made his choices. And in making his choices, he chose. And Lot also did not make choices. And in not making choices, he also chose. Right, so in this case, Esau has chosen, and God sees this as a very active choice. He not as that oppressor oppressed victim mentality that we have in our society. So when could you hop past the three tables? Maybe it's seven or something, where it's got the verse on Hebrews 12 and Malachi. So, I know I'm not supposed to hop off to the rest of the Bible. I'm kind of like breaking my own rule here, because I know that amongst you, there'll be some of you who will ask me, he said, "Wow, Malachi 1, Malachi 1. He says, you know, Jacob and Esau were brothers, meaning that the two of them are under the covenant. Why is it God now says he hates Esau? Well, that's terrible, right? God is a hater. God is a bigot. God is whatever. Okay, wait. Huh? After the whole account, just now we saw, right, there's one line at the bottom. It says, "So Esau despised his birthright." That line at the bottom is God's perspective, God's conclusion. Remember the girlfriend standing outside the toilet? What will she think, right? So this is what God is thinking. What does the word despise mean? It's to show disrespect because you are just not worth it. Right? And this feeling of being, or this verb to despise is an active verb of action, is a verb that comes from the word contempt. Contempt is a internal sense that you are so worthless, I just roll my eyes at you and I just cannot imagine why I'm even spending this kind of time with you, right? So I want to just ask, how many of you here have experienced contempt before? And some of you will have, especially if, let's say you are young adults and you were invited back to your alma mater, right? Like secondary school or primary school. And then they ask you, please help us mentor some, I don't know, kid or troubled kid or whatever, right? And then you went back to help out. But that kid treated you like dirt. I mean, you could be having fun, learning other things, doing stuff on your uni campus, but you took time to come back to meet this kid and help him. But he cannot stand being with you because you are just a waste of his time. If only you don't come, he can be on his videos, consuming his videos, consuming his computer games. But you come, And then you go and show your face in front of him. Now he cannot watch his video. Now he cannot play his games. Oh, just get out of my face. Some of you would have experienced that, right? Some of you who are business people or very successful professionals, you have taken part in some of those mentorship things. Then you go to the poly or the road, whatever, whichever organization. And then you go and give your time as a professional to go and spend time with, a younger, student. And then you are supposed to help him, understand the industry and then get a foot up to be able to be successful in the industry. And you took time out of your business when you could be making a whole lot of money. You took time out of, your work as a professional and you spend time with that person. You were willing to do that. But the person thinks that you are wasting his time. If you really don't come, I could be doing my own thing, eating, sleeping, playing my games. Then you come and now you want to talk to me, now you want to introduce me. They say, "Ayo, please, better you don't come, can or not?" I was asking one quite high-level professional, on Saturday, who's also a dad. I asked, "Can you have a relationship with such a person?" And he's a very caring kind of person. But he said, "Oh, very hard, very hard." You yourself may have no axe to grind with this young person, but he just treats you like dirt because that's what he thinks of you. Okay? And that is the verb, that is the active verb that Hebrews 12 is saying. After that, of course, who doesn't want the extra money? So in Genesis 26, Isaac was going to give the blessing. Jacob came and did his deceitful thing and basically grabbed that blessing out of Esau's hand by deceiving his father, Isaac. You all know the details, you can go and read Genesis 26. But he wrestled that blessing out of Esau's hand, right, and grabbed it for himself. Yeah, that's a problem. Jacob certainly was seriously problematic for doing that. And let's see whether he can do that and get away with it. And let's see whether he will reap what he sows in future. That's Jacob's side. That's correct. He's wrong. He's wrong, right? But we don't see Esau's side, you see. We all see Jacob as being wrong. Okay, correct, correct. And maybe we all see Jacob as being wrong because we're reading the text as a morality text. Don't tell lies, right? And then we say, "Oh, Jacob, go and tell lies." But we don't see Esau's side, that from Hebrews 12, God says, he wanted the blessing. He cried. He wanted the double portion of the money and whatever. But he could not change what he had done. Then you ask yourself, what had he done? I thought when I read the text, he didn't do anything. He was a victim. But God said, "You despised me. You think that I am a burden. You think standing before me is not a privilege. You're trying to get me out of your hair." So this immediacy, this "I need to watch my video now." Watching my video is a consumption one. It's a consumption for my appetite. It's a consumption for what I have. Some of you are playing your video now, huh? Because your friend outside is online now. Then you cannot miss, ma. So that's why you're playing now, ma. Right? Because all of them playing together outside. Then if you don't play now, then how? So you're playing now. This one is Esau, la. Right? Where your appetite, your today, your right now, it's got to be now. If I don't have it now. God, excuse me, get out of the way. God, you are in the way. How go bu tang lu? Excuse me, right? So you see the second one, which is Malachi. This word hate is not an emotion of hostility. It's not the way we use the word hate as an emotion that say, go and die, that kind of thing. I really hate you, please, I cannot stand you. That's not the emotion of hostility towards someone. This word hate in the original Hebrew is actually a particular seed that has thorns. Boop, 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 boop. I mean, I don't know what seed it is. We don't have that in Singapore. But there's a seed that has thorns. And then this particular word, head, is this seed that has thorns. So literally, the word for head is thorn seed. Right? And the picture is the thorns are poking out. And what happens when you reach for a beautiful rose and then the thorns poke you? What do you do? Your response is, ouch, right? Ouch. And then you withdraw, right? You see a cute little kitten you want to go and pet, and then the kitten goes, ah, and the claws come out, right? And what do? Whoa, whoa. Okay? Yeah. So the thorn sticking out, right, at you, and that is what God is saying his experience with Esau is. Remember how it started? I will give the covenant through Isaac. Hooray! And then Isaac prays for his wife Rebekah, and God gives them twins, and both Esau and Jacob are both going to be my chosen people. They're going to be close to me. Esau is going to stand before me, and then I will speak to his people, and he'll remind his people to be faithful to me. He'll tell them about my covenant. And then God is like excited, and he is like raring to go, and now he's a young adult. He's going to be receiving the blessing soon. I mean, that's the next chapter, right? And then as God is standing right there, and then just like the fiancé outside the toilet, right? Standing right there, and Esau comes in, and Jacob says, sell me your birthright. Esau is not saying, what the, right? He's saying, whatever, I don't care. And what did God experience at that moment? What you said just now, ouch, that hurt. You mean that's what you think of me? In this business of your life, you are not thinking that I'm an asset. You think I'm a liability. In this business of your life, the promises that I have been, you know, so joyful to give to your father Isaac, and now it's come to you, you don't see it as accrued income of a faithful God in partnership with you. I am totally going to give you and your ancestors whatever I promised. You think I'm that irresponsible customer and you got to write me off as bad debt. That's how God responded. Whoa. Okay. You think that way of me? Sure. You know, you think God was like far, far away when Esau and Jacob were having the exchange. He was right there, right? Now, back to Jacob. None of us like him. I also don't like him. But you still have to admit he wanted. What did he want? He wanted the birthright. And what does that mean? They said, come on, he just wants the money. You know, he's just selfish. He's just grabbing. Okay, sure. But knowing that a birthright includes the spiritual aspect, he would have also wanted the God part. Okay, you say, where God? At the back, nah, you know, in front is the money part. Then maybe the God part is behind. But, you know, it's still part of the package, ma, right? It's a package, right? So, but Esau didn't even consider that to be of value. And I wonder whether, you know, I am a generation of a Jesus follower who receives a covenant from my father and grandmother who have walked with the Lord. So I just want to speak to those of us who are not first-generation Christians. You all are probably second, third, fourth, like me, you know, not first-generation, right? And you know, when you were born, God gave to your parents a vision that you would be blessed, that the covenant he made with your parents would continue through the next generation. Do you see that as valuable? For many years of my life, I did not. I saw that as a burden. Aya! You know, well, I talk to the second generation, third generation, we'll say, if my parents were not Christians, I can go out and do this, do that, do the other, what. You know, that I can, you know, not be, you know, restrained by whatever, right? Sometimes we have that perspective. But I think, you know, today I just want to challenge us of the next generation to reconsider that, you know, that the Lord, when He gives His promises and gives His blessing, He meant it for you, the next generation. And what is my response? If my response is like Esau, I tell you, that's normal. Because we live in a secular society where my own appetites and my consumption, whether the consumption of my eyes or consumption of my body, my stomach, matters the most. No one's going to say there's a problem. Right? But from God's perspective, He would have a problem because He would say, you have despised me. Okay, now we hop through many, many, many chapters. There are many interesting things. He goes off. His brother is so angry. He's going to kill him for taking his birthright. Of course, we think all be good, right? Because you were the one who went and wrestled the blessing from your brother, right? So he went off, looked for his uncle in Haran. His uncle Laban had a beautiful daughter called Rachel. He's a lucky man. His uncle said, you can marry her. But unfortunately, just as he had cheated on his brother by deceiving his father Isaac, so Laban later on also cheated him. And he didn't just cheat him once, cheated him many times, cheated him by giving him the older daughter rather than Rachel, the younger daughter, in marriage, cheated him by when he said he'll have the speckled sheep, took the speckled sheep and kept it away somewhere. So he ended up with sheep that were genetically less likely to have, you know, the speckled marks on it. So, you know, life was hard. Eventually, of course, eventually the Lord God, because God spoke to him, God appeared to him, God even showed him a ladder coming down from heaven that he is the one who comes near to him. So God told him that the promises that he has are given to Jacob, and also that God will be with him and will bring him back to Canaan someday. So now comes that someday. When God spoke to Jacob, go back to Canaan. Canaan talked to his wives as, because he got cheated with the older one, he still wanted to marry the younger one. But, you know, that's not God's design. And anyone time when we step out of God's design, there's big trouble, you know. All examples of polygamy, multiple wives in the Bible, is all very clear evidence that the families were dysfunctional, people were unhappy, it was really quite a bad situation, right? So, well, anyway, culturally, that's what he did. He ended up marrying both sisters, as well as the and then the maidservants were given to him as well, so he had children by then. So by then, he had about 10, 11 children. I'm not really sure when Benjamin was born, somewhere in between there. And his two wives and the wives' maidservants, who are some of his son's mothers. So one whole big group with their sheep, they left the uncle Laban and they were traveling back. Now, by now, they cannot go back to Laban, the uncle, because of the bad blood between them. Laban's sons were very angry with Jacob because he was still prosperous, even though they tried to cheat him. So now he cannot go back to Laban. He must go back to Canaan. The problem is when he reached the three-quarter mark, you know, almost reaching back, he was told that his brother Esau had heard that he was coming and he was going to come to him. And obviously from your earlier time with Esau, you know that he's coming to take revenge and he's going to destroy you and probably kill off everyone in your household, or maybe take everyone else as slaves or something like that. So it's a very brutal situation he's in. It's he's on his own. There's no one else to help him. Laban is not going to help him. Laban's sons are already very angry with him, right? So obviously that part is gone. So he's really all alone in this. He divides his family into two. He tries to do that, hoping that one group will escape. And then he sends them across the Jabbok River, and then now he is there alone. Now imagine his psychological state when he's alone. You can imagine the stress that, you know, this person who has been wanting revenge on you for years is now coming with an army to look for you. Does this mean that this is Jacob's last night on earth? Is it better that Esau come and find him and kill him first so that he is no longer so angry and perhaps he can let the women and the children live? Or will he just be on a, you know, killing spree along the way, because there's a line of people in front of Jacob, right? So he's already very under a great pressure, a lot of stress, you know, I don't know, I think partially some depression, some, you know, it's your last night on earth. How do you make sense of that? I don't think he's asleep, right? And it's completely pitch black. And then he sees a shadow. And you know, this is bandit country, cowboy country, right? Like, everyone takes care of themselves. So this person is coming probably to steal his money. So he gives a warning, right, to scare that guy away. But that man audaciously still comes over to him and wants to grab him. So of course, Jacob, who is a strong guy, jumps up and grabs him back, right? I mean, you got to protect yourself, right? And when I look at these wrestling videos, I can see that it's a really intense sport. I don't really see how you can... Usually one thing going back and forth can last 7 seconds. I don't know how you're going to last 7 minutes. I don't know how they last 7 hours, because they have to last until daybreak, and daybreak is somewhere around 6:37, around the January time when the lambs have their baby lambs, right? The ewes have their baby lambs. It says that Jacob said the lambs have got their baby lambs, so he told Esau, we cannot rush, right? So it's around that time. So daybreak is around 6:30. I don't really know how they could grapple each other, and then they break apart, then they're panting, and then that guy comes at him again. And so now we are at the point of the wrestling. Could we read Genesis 32 together? Next slide, yeah. Okay, let's read Genesis 32. 1, 2, 3. So I was wondering, what does this scene look like? When I look at all the pictures on the internet, Jacob wrestles with God or something, they put an angel, then they'll show Jacob going like that, you know, like that, you know, like, you know, quite nice pictures. But I'm like, oh, okay, is that what it looked like when Jacob was actually doing that? Because this is a real incident, right? And then I also wondered, this man came and grabbed hold of Jacob. So when daylight came and you want to leave, you are the one who grabbed him. So you let go of him and run away. So how come you were the one who grabbed him, and now when it's daybreak, you don't let go of him and run away? What? That means Jacob is now grabbing you? But at the front, wasn't it you grabbing him? What happened at daybreak? What did Jacob see or perceive when daybreak came that now it turned the other way and Jacob is grabbing him? Right? What did he see at daybreak? Then it says, when the man could not overpower him, he touched his hip and kapong, his hip got dislodged. I'm dislocated. But I'm thinking, if you already know that you can go kaping and his hip gets dislocated, then how, it's not like you can't overpower him. This is a contradiction of terms, right? When I look at those WWE, right, and then WWE wrestler destroys so and so. I mean, he's already destroyed you, right? So what more is there to do? And then after that, then he says, "Let me go." Wait, you've just dislocated his hip. Shouldn't it be, "Let me go"? I won't let you go. Then you dislocate his hip. You already dislocated his hip. What? Then now you want to say, let me go? What? And then I was thinking through. You know, just some time ago, I remember I was in the Katong village, sitting down there waiting for a group of young adults, and then y'all were waiting for each other. And then one of you, you're quite tall, right? You're like 1.85 or something. I don't know. I think you're taller than me. And then while y'all were waiting, you were waiting for one of the young adults. I don't know, see him. Then you, that guy, right? You were standing there, and then there was this little guy, he was grabbing hold of your shin, because you are so tall, right? Then he was going, ooh. Then you went, ooh, him. Then after that, you pick him up, then you threw him in the air. Wahey! You threw him up. I mean, I could see the space between him and your head. I mean, you really threw him up. Then he was like, ooh, right? Then after that, you caught him, then you put him down. He came at you again. Then he grabbed your shin. Then one of the other young adults said to you, he won't let you go. Then after you said to him, one more time, then I really have to go. Then you pick him up and then you threw him again 3 times. I thought that was kind of cute because he's so small. He was grabbing on your shin. Then I was thinking, oh, that's interesting. Like, you don't have to say, let me go. After one more time, must let me go. You don't have to ask him to let you go. You just go. Like, you are 1.85, you know. He's not even like 0.8 or something like that, you know. So why did you say to him, you must let me go, after one more time. And then you've just thrown him in the air. That throwing in the air obviously shows that you have way, your power is way more then his little against your shin, right? So what were you doing? Why is it you didn't just go, right? You even after you threw him, you say, oh, one more time, then you must let me go. So why is it this person has obviously shown his power by touching Jacob's hip and dislocated it, but he didn't just, you know, go? He said, let me go. It's like, what? You know, is he doing, when you, as a young adult, when you were doing that with that little kid, was there something, one reason why you were doing that? What does that show about what you were trying to do with him? You were trying to keep up some kind of a relationship with him? You were trying to keep things going with him? You wanted him to keep pushing at your shin? You wanted to keep playing that rambunctious wrestling game with him? Right? I mean, just try to think from this man's perspective. Later on, Jacob says, I saw the face of God, right? And I lived, right? That means this man was actually God. Now, wait. He said, let me go, for it is daybreak. You mean God didn't bring his watch? And then it was daybreak. Oops. You know how you play computer game? Aya, I have to go for tuition. Aya, I'm late. Aya. Thank God he's on there. Wrestle. It's daybreak. You know, like, of course not. Like, he no, still. So what was he doing? Was he lingering on? Did he purposely let Jacob see his face? See who he is? And then when Jacob realized who he is, let Jacob grab hold of him. He's still fighting with Jacob, but he's letting him come at him. And I want to ask you why. You know, why did God do all this with him? And the strangest part is when they're wrestling, all the videos that I watch, the WWE and all that, you in the middle of the wrestling, do they stop and say, "Hi, what's your name?" Right? Why in the middle God said, then what if you said Jacob? Then God will say, "Oh, I got the wrong person. Sorry, I jumped on the wrong person in the night." Like, you better check in the beginning, right? Was he asking that for information? Remember Adam and Eve? That God was not asking for information when he came and he called. I asked the media team to show you two short videos. It's only 2.5, 3 minutes. And then the other one is only, I think, 1 minute plus. I want you to imagine that scene of the wrestling after the hip dislocation. Because I can't see any of that on the internet. So I imagine after the hip dislocation, they are still wrestling. How does that look like? So since none of y'all do wrestling, as far as I know, except one jujitsu one, but the rest of y'all don't, so I'm going to give you just a very, very short 2.5 minute video so that you can understand what Jacob and God were doing together.
Thanks. From here, the first thing I want to focus on is isolating the leg. A lot of people go for this backside finish, but their opponents keep facing them. So I keep circling, they keep facing me. We end up in this position where we're continually trying to circle and our opponent continually faces us. I can lock my hands together, pull the leg in, and get my elbow behind his calf. When my elbow is behind his calf, his leg is stuck like this. And he can no longer face me without hurting his knee. So my elbow goes to the mat, and I continue to pull this leg in. A lot of people are gonna sprawl with their hip into you from here. You feel that, Will? So kind of sprawl sideways. Go ahead and pull the leg in and put your elbow to the mat. You wanna get to a position where my hips are over top of the mat. You see how he has my knee closer to him? This is a position where my leg is isolated. His elbow's behind my calf, my knee is closer to him than my hips. I have gonna have a lot of trouble facing and sprawling him. I need to shift into him, so now see how my hips are over my knee, or my hips are even more into you. This is where I can defend. So not only do you want your elbow to the mat, so Will has my elbow to the mat, but you wanna drive in, you wanna really pull this leg into you so that I can't pivot. So really get a good look at this position here. You pull the leg in tight, you've isolated my calf, I can no longer defend this way, and you're gonna force me to defend with a knee slip position, which we'll talk about in the advanced section. I lock, I pull this leg in, I get my elbow to the mat, and I'm really continuing to pull this leg in and drive my shoulder into his hamstring. Another thing I'll do to help me isolate this leg is pressure into the person. I'm driving with this left leg. I'll even post my left hand. I don't want Will to be able to use his whizzer to throw me down to my elbow or to my head. I have to keep a lot of pressure into him. Hand, foot, driving here. No space with my neck, head glued to his leg. So that's the first thing, isolate the leg. Elbows behind the calf. I hug above his knee. Now I want to get his opposite knee down. It's very hard to circle behind him when he has a lot of pressure or a lot of weight on this knee. As I drive into him, if I can get that opposite knee down, this leg that I have is now light, and I can start circling behind, shelving, and looking to finish here.
Okay, so that's the teaching. Now it'll be the actual wrestling. So I'll show you what it's like to wrestle when you don't have one leg. So think of Jacob and the reality. Yeah, thanks.
Let's talk about how this man, Anthony Robles of Arizona State University, won an NCAA championship with only one leg. His opponent is the reigning national champion at this weight, Matt McDonough of the University of Iowa. Whistle blows and the Hawkeye immediately pressures forward and takes control of the center circle. The Sun Devil peels that hand off his head and uses his vice grip to arm drag his opponent and gain a better angle on the Hawkeye. Yet McDonough is fending off Robles' offense. Anthony, however, is relentless with his attack and stabs his head into the side of Matt's body, which ultimately awards the Sun Devil a 2-point takedown. After 42 seconds, McDonough Stunner receives his first stall warning for his lack of action, to which Robles responds by flipping forward to tilt his opponent to his back, though no points are scored until the referee swipes his hand a couple of times, which ends up being worth 2 near fall points, making the score now 4-0 in favor of ASU. However, Anthony is not done yet, as he rolls through yet again to expose Matt's back to the mat, this time for a full 5 seconds, which is worth 3 additional near fall points. At the end of the period, McDonough fights to pry Robles off his leg, but time expires with the Sun Devil being up 7 points to nothing. In the second period, there are no points scored, but there is plenty of action here. Watch how the Hawkeye circles one way, now goes the other, circles back the other way, and Anthony catches the leg of Matt. In the closing seconds, McDonough gets completely behind Robles, but the Sun Devil wisely faces him to hold on to the lead. Now we're at the final period where Anthony chooses to be put in the bottom position, where if he escapes, he earns 1 point or 2 points for reversing the position if he manages to find his way on top. Despite a valiant effort on both sides to score points, Anthony Robles gives up 2 stall calls, which results in 1 point for Matt McDonough. But it doesn't matter much because the Sun Devil finishes the match with the final score of 7-1, making Anthony Robles the 2011 national champion at 100.
Okay, so I want to ask you, why did God do this with Jacob? Just think of how when he came to Hagar, right? He came to Hagar, Hagar was crying. Hagar, you know, maidservant of Sarai, where are you going to? Where are you running to? Where have you come from? And then she said, oh, I'm running from my, from Sarai. And then she says, you are pregnant. You're going to have a child. You will name him Ishmael. How about that? How about come to Jacob? Jacob, son of Isaac, where are you running to? Oh, don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. Why don't God say that? Why this? A lot of trouble. I was thinking through, why did God do this? And when I go on to the next slide, the one on his character. So you have Jacob. I think that the reason God did that is because he wanted to bring Jacob back to that moment and reenact that he would live out again that wrestling for blessing. I won, I'm grabbing. He had done that before. Chapter 25, chapter 26, he had done that before. That was his past. That was who he was. Jacob is the supplanter, the one who trips someone up in order to take his place to deceit. God was bringing him back to live out that scene again. But in recreating his scene, God coming back with him into that scene, God wanted to now rewrite his identity in that scene. For a few of y'all who have done inner healing, y'all do something like that, right? Y'all will say to the person, the Lord Jesus will bring you back to the place of that moment. Where is Jesus in that place? Right? That's usually a line you will ask the person you're ministering to. Something like that, yeah. So God brings him back. But now when you are wrestling and grabbing and wanting blessing, you are grabbing from who? It's no longer grabbing from Esau. It's grabbing from me. And I find that a very strange thing that when God rewrote his name, he called him Israel, the one who grabbed God, the one who struggled with God and won. And I was like, who won? I thought God won, but God said he won. You know, like, who won? Right? And God said, Jacob won. He wanted the blessing. I gave it to him. And why that new name? Why that new identity? I find it very strange that God did not tell Jacob, ha ha ha, you've been a grabber, now be a good boy and stop grabbing. He didn't say that. He said, grab more, grab me, right? You don't stop grabbing. The problem is you kept grabbing from Esau and Isaac and whatever. Grab me. And when he grabbed God gave him that new identity. You are the one who grabs God, right? And now I give you that identity and along with that, the blessing, right? So eventually, after he had received that new identity, then we go on to the last slide. He came back down and Jabbok River is right down base below. And then he went up to Shechem. Shechem is at the heart of Canaan. He bought a piece of land, and because God had brought him back, he told his wives to say, all your false gods that you have in your bags, in your luggage, give it to me. I'm going to bury it under a tree. From now on, the God Elohim, El Elohe, Elohe means Elohim, the God Elohim of Genesis 1, that will be my God. I was just reading up on this word called situationship in social media. In psychology, it says, when you are with someone and that relationship is never defined, that's kind of a problem for one side, the side that is, you know, giving to that relationship. But the person on the other side doesn't want it to be defined, because if you define a relationship, it means you are committing to the relationship. So if one side tries to ask the other to define the relationship, because he wants to stop this situationship and start getting clear about what this is about, the other side will say to him, no, thank you. I don't appreciate you for asking us to define the relationship. And the reason that one side prefers not to define a relationship and keep it as a situationship is because she sometimes is the one getting the benefits, because one is giving the effort, right? And the person who is receiving does not want to define, because he wants to just get the benefits without any commitment. We can see that Jacob did not leave it as a situationship. He defined the relationship. El Elohe Israel, you are my God. Elohim of Genesis 1 is my God. And I wonder, for some of us, you are very welcome as you sit in our midst. Thank you so much for coming. You have been here for a while. Would you like to define your relationship with the Most High God? For some of us, we come, our cell groups pray for us. You are receiving. You are on the receiving end. And you're happy with that. But are you receiving and not wanting to define the relationship with the Most High God? I would like to challenge you today to say El Elohe and your name, right? And at the end of May, there's going to be a spiritual formation to help you understand what it means to be in relationship with this Most High God. Baptism and everything will be explained during that time. I hope that you can ask your cell leader for the dates and come and join us, right? Define your relationship with Elohim. Okay, so now he's back with Dad. So I have a few application questions for you in your notes. I would like to ask you, just give you a few seconds to think. The first question is, are you godly or are you godless? Now, this word godly and godless, I didn't preach a topic on it, but godless is the people during Noah's time where they lived for today and did not take the warning of God for tomorrow, even though God waited 969 years. So the people of Noah's time and Esau are same. They are godless because the things of God were not in their consideration. God's warnings, the appetite of themselves, as Jesus explained, the people during Noah's time were buying and selling and eating and drinking and living life for today as we always do. But the godly are people like Noah and Jacob. They were not good from our Asian society perspective, but they wanted. And Jacob was aggressive in wanting God. He was a grabber. And God affirmed him and said, that's how I want you to be. Not change and become Mr. Nice Guy, but you grab me, right? Don't go grabbing your brother's blessing. Grab me, right? You are the one who seeks me, right? Are you one who is aggressively seeking after the things of God? Or do you feel like just being passive is how you want to be, right? Or are you godless? You know, our Christian homes can be godly Christian homes And our Christian homes can be godless Christian homes. A godless Christian home is not being bad people, huh? Right? It's not that. It's how Esau was. What I consume today is the most important from my eyes, ears, my stomach. And then the last two questions has to do with if you are struggling with God, I hope that you can talk a little bit about it, ask, you know, for prayer, talk about how you are in your struggle with God. Some of you are going through tough times. You're wondering whether you can hold on. You know, God is making it so that you can keep holding on, and He wants to release that blessing and give you a new identity. Some of you have struggled with God and you have the scars to show it. A lot of times when we say we come to God, it's because we want the blessing, right? But do you know that when we head on, shoulder on, bone engage with God, we also get scars and new identities and a new blessing that we never imagined possible. Yeah. Okay. So come, let's pray and we'll end. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for showing us the grabber, Jacob. Thank you for teaching us what it means to wrestle with you, to engage with you. Will you help us, Lord, to be aggressively seeking you, just like Jacob? We receive this from what you're sharing with us today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.